Hey, good morning, everybody. Good morning, good morning, good morning. Welcome to class. And for a moment, I'm going to turn some of these lights off. Today is May 12th. And we're in the urinary chapter. We'll take a look at the schedule in just a second. So I don't like those lights. That one I'll leave on. Maybe this one I'll turn off. This looks good. Okay, so the schedule for today, May 12th, renal physiology, that's chapter 17. We'll get to talk about that next time, but I'll probably start diversification system next time, and I'll give you the information that you need to know what end of chapter questions that I'd like, and you know the exam figure for the exam, for that part. Okay, anybody have a question on the schedule?
You said next time, like as in Thursday?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Unless I email it to you before then.
For Tuesday
of next week? Well, what I'm going to give you next time are the questions numbers that I like at the end of the chapter, okay, that you should study for the exam. And the exam figure, there's one exam figure in that chapter, and that is 20.33, I think.
Yeah,
it's the graph that gives you the profiles of FSH, LH, progesterone, estrogen during the ovarian cycle and uterine cycle, right? And it shows you the changes in the endometrium, changes within the ovary during those two cycles. Okay. So we will still have a lecture covering that material on Tuesday of next week, and then maybe some review if you have questions. Make sure you bring in some questions. And then a week and a half from today is your last exam, exam number 4. And I do believe I have the correct chapter numbers down, 14, 16, 17, and 20. That's it. Okay? I'm not quite sure I heard. Just that exam figure and some end of chapter questions. So I do want you to do some reading so you can understand how to answer those questions. Right? So I'm not going to go through 50 slides on chapter 20 on Thursday and Tuesday of next week. All right, so that's the schedule. Did I see a question? No, that was it. All right. Well, let's try to finish up urinary system. Well, we got some time, so I don't necessarily have to finish it up today, but we might just do that. So let's switch over to 1 and 1, and I'm going to go back just a little bit. Make sure that you understand the anatomy of that structural and functional unit of urine formation. First, you got to tell me what the structural and functional unit of urine formation is. It's a nephron. Fantastic. Be able to draw that out on a piece of paper just from memory so that you understand the various elements that make up a nephron. What kind of fluid is moving through these tubes, right? And so that's going to be really important. So who's a little shaky on their nephron? If we have time today, is that a little shaky on it? Okay, maybe we need to draw it out again. I don't think I want to take time right now, but we might have a little bit of time at the end of the chapter. But that might be wasted time. Now is a good time because you really have to know this before we can finish this discussion, right? All right, so if you think of a nephron, you can break it down into some components, right? You got something complicated, what do? Break it down into something simpler, right? And there are two simpler ways that you can think of a nephron in terms of their structure. What are the two things that make up a nephron? Okay, proximal and distal convoluted tubule. Those are two things, but not major categories of how I would want to... I like vascular and tubular elements, right? Which then means that you should know what's in a vascular element.
Blood.
What's in a tubular element? Filtrate. Wonderful. Okay. So that's a good place to start. So let's just write it down here. So first thing right here, number one, we're going to say tubular elements. All right, and so just in your mind, just trace a drop of whatever is in a tubular element. As a matter of fact, tell me that right now. What's in a tubular element? Yeah, that's the structure, but I want to know the fluid that's inside these. Yeah, filtrate. Fantastic. All right, so if we take a drop of filtrate, where does it originate? And tell me all the structures that it goes through in the proper order. All right, so it originates in Bowman's capsule. And the process in Bowman's capsule is filtration. Nice, filtration. All right, and then the filtrate goes into proximal convoluted tubule. Then the descending loop of Henle, right, going down into the medulla. And then the ascending loop of Henle. Hopefully this is okay that I'm using abbreviations for you guys. All right, and then if there's a proximal convoluted tubule, there's got to be a distal convoluted tubule. And then that filtrate is going to empty into a collecting duct. And somewhere in this collecting duct, maybe in the middle or toward the distal end, this filtrate then becomes urine. Okay. So all these tubules contain filtrate, but at the end of the collecting duct, it is now completely processed and it's urine. So if you have excess water in your body, you're going to have very dilute urine. If you have excess salt in your body, then you're going to have very salty urine. Right, so that's the job of this nephron. All right, so that's tubular elements. Then what do we got after that? I'm going to put two over here on the left because I want a little bit of board over there. You have vascular elements. And again, if we're going to trace a drop of blood, all right, where should we start? Afferent arteriole. And then a capillary, right? Because an arteriole always brings blood to a capillary. That is... I'm not going to say it. You got to say it. Yeah, glomerulus. Glomerulus. All right, and then here's something strange. Since a glomerulus is a capillary, blood usually flows into a venule after that, but not in the nephron. It flows into another arteriole, right, which is the efferent arteriole. And what does an arteriole always bring blood to? Here's an arteriole bringing blood to a capillary. Here's another arteriole bringing blood to another capillary. Yeah, so this is a portal blood vessel. All right, and the second capillary is what we call the peritubular capillaries, and now blood flows into the venule going back to the heart. All right, so here is capillary number one. Here is capillary number two, and in between them is a portal blood vessel. And probably you should have in the back of your mind a couple other examples of portal systems. Maybe we didn't go over them in physiology, but in anatomy you sure did. Like the hepatic portal system, right? The hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system that we did go over. Okay, so let's draw this out. Let's start with tubular elements first. So what do I got to draw?
Bowman's capsule. Like so. All right, so I'm just going to type or write BC
right there for Bowman's capsule.
What's in Bowman's capsule?
Yeah, the glomerulus is the structure, but the fluid is called filtrate. So
this is where filtration takes place. So then the filtrate moves into the? Yeah, proximal convoluted tubule. This is in the cortex. Then that filtrate is going to go down into the medulla. Descending loop of Henle, and then it goes back up to the cortex, ascending loop of Henle, and then guess what we got right here? Yeah, distal convoluted tubule, and that goes into collecting duct, right? And so that's urine that's going to go to a tip of a renal pyramid. Sometimes we call that a papillae, then into the minor calyx, right? Major calyx, pelvis, and then out of the body. And you know what? Let's just connect this up, right? Because it really should be connected up just like that.
Okay, so it's a nice simplified diagram. Some diagrams in your book, these things might be reversed. This might come over here and loop around and come back. So you always trace it. The descending loop is going to be attached to the PCT. Ascending loop is not going to be attached to the PCT. It's going to be attached to the DCT, right? Got to follow that order. Okay, vascular system.
Here is a blood vessel bringing blood into this glomerulus. Here's the glomerulus. Looks kind of like a meatball, right? And so that is a capillary. Glomerulus is a capillary. So this blood vessel is an arteriole, and in particular, yeah, the afferent arteriole. Then blood is going to come out of this capillary, go to that portal blood vessel that we call the efferent arteriole, and then that arteriole is going to feed another capillary. Right, so here's another capillary bed just kind of squishing around all over the place, surrounding all of these tubules. So these are what we call the peritubular capillaries. And then this is going to go out to a venule. Right, and then since this is, okay, what kind of vein is it going to go into? Name that vein.
Yeah, renal vein. Exactly right, because we're talking about kidney. I was just wondering if people, okay, would remember the organ we're talking about. That's good. You pulled that out. That's wonderful. Okay, so we have filtrate here. We got urine there. Right, we got blood right here. So we got blood going into the nephron. What are the three processes that have to take place that will take blood and make urine? Okay. I like this first one you mentioned.
Something is going to go from blood. See this dot right here? It's on the blood vessel in the glomerulus.
That's the origin of this fluid, the material.
And it's going to go into Bowman's capsule. We're going to label that number one.
Okay. And you told me number one is nice filtration.
All right, and the product of filtration is filtrate. And this is a completely passive process.
It's driven by the pressure, high pressure inside the glomerulus, low in Bowman's capsule. And any small molecule will be filtered. Water, sodium, potassium, glucose, smaller proteins, right, can be filtered. It's just by size.
Water. Hopefully I mentioned water. Water is a good thing to have in your body. Right, so that gets filtered.
So that's the first process. But you lose so much water in this process, you would dehydrate in just a couple minutes. Because I think you make, anybody remember, 150 liters a day of filtrate? It's in your notes somewhere. So this is a high rate of filtration. So whatever in the filtrate that I have right here in this proximal convoluted tubule is going to end up in urine. We don't want to lose all that water. So let's draw something in here. So we got some substances that is in filtrate, and that's going to end up in urine, but we want this material, for instance, like water. How does it get back into your body? Yeah, so here is process number two. Okay, so that's resorption number two. And we're going to call it tubular resorption. That's nice. So what are some things? Glucose. Normal individual, 100% of the glucose is resorbed, right, in that area. 100% of potassium is going to be reabsorbed. Some sodium is going to be resorbed. Okay, and I guess some proteins, when they get through, some proteins can be actively transported back. And don't forget our favorite solvent, which is water, can be resorbed. And how am I doing? Can you read that okay? Mostly? Yeah.
For resorption, does it only happen in the PCT or does it happen anywhere else?
The PCT, resorption happens at full blast. Okay, it's going 100% of the time as fast as it can. But your body's, your intake changes. The proximal convoluted tubule can't adjust for those changes of what you take in, ingestion, right? So your body adjusts for how much you take in this segment over here, the distal convoluted tubule and collecting duct, right? So resorption can take place, DCT and collecting duct, and it can vary. It can go up and down depending on the body's needs. Resorption does take place in the proximal convoluted tubule, but it's constant. It's maximum, okay? So I think does that answer your question with a little bit more detail? Nice. Okay. Glucose, potassium, sodium, proteins, water, tubular resorption.
All right, but there still might be some harmful compounds in blood that's going to stay in your body because it's going to go into the renal vein, back to the heart.
And it could be certain drugs. It can be toxic compounds. It can be something like excess sodium, excess potassium. Urea would be a really good compound to consider in this circumstance. So we have urea, right, that's in the blood, and it's going to be put into
this tubule right here. This is number 3.
And that is, right, so this right here, we call that
tubular. Doesn't sound like I mentioned this last time, but how you're helping me. Secretion. Yeah, tubular secretion. Harmful compounds. We'll just put urea, for instance, right there. All right, so don't forget, what's the material in this ascending loop of Henle? Okay, yeah, there's some urea, but it is filtrate. Yeah, filtrate, and that's going to become urine eventually. All right, so the other thing that you should be really aware of is what's the origin and where does it end up? It's on the illustration, but let's put it in text form right here. Filtration, how does something move? From where does it originate? Yeah, it originates in blood.
Substance in blood, all that water was in blood. And where does it go? It becomes?
Yeah, filtrate. Nice. Like so. What about tubular resorption? How does something move? I like it. Filtrate. Filtrate to blood. Nice. All of these goodies right there that you don't want to lose.
All right, and what about tubular secretion?
Yeah, blood to filtrate. All right, so now you see what I was getting at right here. Some of these nice, simple descriptions are very handy. Blood to, filtrate. And we have them listed right here.
Okay, I think that kind of works. Okay, so the amount of filtrate that is produced for a certain unit of time is called the glomerular filtration rate. The amount of filtrate that is produced. And under usual circumstances, the glomerular filtration rate should remain constant. It shouldn't go up and down with blood pressure. And so there are some mechanisms that will adjust that. So if blood pressure goes up and down, okay, the glomerular filtration rate will stay the same. And that's what I have on the slide right here. There are two ways. At least intrinsic ways. This is just what found right in the kidney. Doesn't require any nervous system or anything. Myogenic constriction and tubuloglomerular feedback. The first one is easy to understand. There are some smooth muscles right around the afferent arteriole. And, of course, these smooth muscles are circular. When they constrict, what happens to blood flow into the glomerulus when there's constriction? It decreases, right? That's Poiseuille's equation, radius times radius times radius times radius in the numerator. Okay, so when blood pressure goes up, the resistance of the glomerulus doesn't change, so that would increase blood flow into the glomerulus, that would increase GFR, but we don't want to increase GFR. How can we maintain GFR, right, when blood pressure goes up? Yeah, this constricts, right, and so blood flow decreases, even though blood pressure increases, that maintains GFR at that constant level. All right, so that's what we call myogenic constriction. Tubuloglomerular feedback. It is achieved because a certain part of the nephron will secrete a chemical that can either dilate or constrict that same area. And I have to figure out exactly what I'm going to talk about in a little bit better detail, tubuloglomerular filtrate, and I'll do that in just a second. And tell you the truth, I'm not even sure I can teach you guys this stuff, but I'm going to try. Okay? All right, and you can tell me how I did in a little bit. All right, and just remember, tubuloglomerular feedback is still intrinsic, which is autoregulation, right? Autoregulation. And that is due to a structure we call the juxtaglomerular apparatus. I'm going to draw it out on a board. We'll label some of the structures and then figure out what happens. But you can see that it has some effect on that afferent arteriole to cause constriction or dilation, which is going to adjust glomerular filtration rate. All right, so I talked about all this stuff already, and we ended up, a really good exam figure, and I think we ended up here last time. I want to finish this little topic off and then get into that juxtaglomerular apparatus. So I'm going to turn some of these lights off once again. Okay, so here are the three processes, correct? We got filtration, blood to filtrate in Bowman's capsule. Then we have resorption in the proximal convoluted tubule going 100% of the time. Some adjustments can also be made in the distal tubules to match the demands of the body. So that's resorption, process number two. Process number three, after filtration, there are still harmful compounds in the efferent arteriole which can be placed in the filtrate, which is going to be excreted, like even some drugs, urea, other kinds of harmful compounds. Excess sodium, excess potassium can end up in the filtrate with this process we call secretion. So we can think of something called renal clearance, just thinking of these three processes. So what is the rate of excretion? Well, it's going to be the rate of filtration, right, because that's going to cause excretion, and plus the rate of secretion. So filtration plus secretion will tell us how much is going to be excreted, but don't forget, some is resorbed. We have to subtract that amount of material. So we got excretion rate is filtration plus secretion minus resorption rate. That will tell us what's in the filtrate, what we are excreting. So that's a pretty nice, easy concept to understand. Glucose. What can you tell me about glucose? Important in your body? Yeah, absolutely, right? You can make a ton of ATP from it with oxidative respiration. But glucose is a small enough molecule that it is filtered, and it goes into proximal convoluted tubule, and if it stays in the filtrate, then of course you lose it from your body in urine. There are transporters, and I think we looked at those transporters already, and I'm just going to finish up some comments with that. 100% of glucose in a normal individual is resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule. And it's a carrier-mediated transport, right? And it's driven by a sodium gradient, so it is secondary active transport. We looked at those transporters, the scheme across the walls of that proximal convoluted tubule. And since it's a carrier-mediated transport, glucose has to bind to what you could consider an active site, and there are only so many of these transporters and active sites in the proximal convoluted tubule. And so we can measure how much glucose can be transported at a particular time if we completely fill up all of those receptors for glucose. And what do we say happens when all the receptors for glucose are bound to glucose? That is saturation, right? That's just something, one characteristic of something that has an active site or a binding site to it. And when all of the active sites are bound, then you're going to get a maximum amount of glucose transported from filtrate back into the blood, and we call that the transport maximum. If there is a concentration of glucose above that transport maximum, then glucose is going to be lost in the urine, and you know that condition to be called diabetes mellitus, right? And glucose is going to end up in the urine. And I think you do the experiment in lab where you actually taste urine to see if it's sweet or not, right? That's how it was diagnosed years ago. It's good to revisit all some of those techniques. Okay. Amino acid transporters can become saturated too, so there are amino acid transporters because amino acids are small enough molecules that they will be filtered as well. So they have transport maximum as well. Now the amount of glucose in the blood, when all the transporters get saturated, we call that the renal plasma threshold. And I think probably some of you realize that's around what? Around 200 milligrams per deciliter of plasma. If glucose gets over that concentration, then we say it gets spilled into the urine. It can't be resorbed. If glucose concentration exceeds this 200 milligrams per deciliter, then we call that hyperglycemia because it has exceeded the renal threshold. And glucose is going to end up in the urine, and of course we call that. That produces glycosuria. Glucose in the urine is glycosuria, and that's an indication for diabetes mellitus. All right. Now, I want to get back to eventually that juxtaglomerular apparatus, because we're going to look at some electrolyte control, how balance is maintained in your body. Your book also talks about acid-base balance, but we probably won't get into that. We're just going to be mostly concerned with sodium and potassium. Okay, so I want to ask you, oh, look at that. Just moved right ahead really fast. Okay, before I go to that next slide, I want to ask you about aldosterone. Right. And we've talked about aldosterone before. It's part of that renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. But bottom line, what does aldosterone do? Okay, certainly resorption of sodium. So taking sodium from filtrate, putting it back into the blood. Okay, so that's one important thing. What about something else? Okay, and water kind of goes along for the ride, maybe. Okay, but I'm also thinking of one other important electrolyte. Yeah, potassium. So sodium goes from filtrate to blood. What about potassium? Does it go from filtrate to blood? It goes the opposite way. Right? It goes from blood to filtrate. What do we call that process, blood to filtrate? Nice, that's secretion. All right, so on a board exam, when you get a question about aldosterone and you got a couple answers like it increases secretion of both, would that be a right answer? No, because it goes in opposite directions. Increases resorption of both. Could that be a right answer? No, without even knowing anything about it, you can say no. So the correct answer would be potassium and sodium going in opposite directions. That's going to be the right question, and hopefully they won't ask you one which direction which is going, right? But that's what we got to talk about right now, and I think it will be nice and easy to appreciate that and why they are going in opposite directions. Well, you're really familiar already with something that makes sodium and potassium go in opposite directions. Yeah, the sodium-potassium ATP pump. That's what most of our energy is expended for, just to maintain that pump. All right, so the kidneys regulate sodium, potassium, and a bunch of these other ions by matching excretion to how much we ingest or how much we produce in our body. Control of plasma sodium is important because it helps regulate blood pressure, it helps regulate blood volume, and also participates a little bit in resting membrane potential and depolarization, so it's an important electrolyte. Same thing for potassium. It's important for the proper function of cardiac and skeletal muscles, and it's also important for the second phase of an action potential, which is, yeah, repolarization, right? Sodium is important for that first part of an action potential, which is depolarization, all right? So your body has to regulate these things. 90% of that filtered sodium and potassium is resorbed in the distal tubule. Okay, oh no, before the distal tubule, which is what? The proximal convoluted tubule. This statement is almost right. 90% of sodium is resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule, and probably you should say even 100% of the potassium is resorbed. So in the filtrate, in the distal convoluted tubule, there shouldn't be any potassium. It's all going to be resorbed. Unless something happens, right? Aldosterone is responsible for regulating how much sodium is going to be resorbed in the distal convoluted tubule, and if there's excess potassium in your body, how much potassium is going to be secreted into the distal convoluted tubule. That's the job of aldosterone. All right, so in the absence of aldosterone, 80% of the remaining sodium is resorbed in that distal tubule and collecting duct. When aldosterone is high, all the sodium is resorbed, right? So aldosterone is important, you guys told me, for resorption of sodium, filtrate to blood, right? Especially in the distal convoluted tubule. Aldosterone works on the distal convoluted tubule to resorb sodium from filtrate. So here is an illustration that I mentioned for potassium. It is almost 100% resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule, and with adjustments in aldosterone, some can be secreted into the distal convoluted tubule under the presence of stimulation of aldosterone. All right, so this is the beast that we want to look at right here, the juxtaglomerular apparatus. And before we look at the detail of the juxtaglomerular apparatus, here is your nephron, right? Bowman's capsule, glomerulus on the inside. And we have filtrate in Bowman's capsule moving into, where do I have the cursor right now? Proximal convoluted tubule, then we got the descending loop, ascending loop, and now we have the distal convoluted tubule, and now this illustration is pretty accurate. The distal convoluted tubule goes right between the afferent and efferent arteriole. It passes right in between them. All right, so this area right here is what we call the juxtaglomerular apparatus. Right, juxta means positioned next to. And so this thing is positioned next to what? The glomerulus. Yeah, glomerulus. All right, so what are the parts of this juxtaglomerular apparatus? Well, here I see the afferent arteriole and efferent arteriole. We're mostly going to be concerned about the afferent arteriole. There's going to be some smooth muscle special structures around the afferent arteriole which can dilate and constrict, and that will regulate blood flow into the glomerulus dramatically. And when blood flow is regulated in the glomerulus, what else is being regulated? Yes, glomerular filtration rate, exactly. So control of this area right here is pretty important. Some of these special cells around the afferent arteriole are what we call granular cells. All right, so here I see granular cells. So consider these granular cells part of the afferent arteriole, and they butt up against that, what, the distal convoluted tubule, and you can see some of the cells of the distal convoluted tubule look a little bit different. And these are what we call the macula denta cells. Macula denta cells can help control blood pressure, can help control what these granular cells do, and also how the smooth muscles react. And that's what I need to tell you about. All right, but first, the pieces of the juxtaglomerular apparatus. The afferent arteriole, which can regulate blood pressure into the glomerulus, the granular cells, right, of macula densa of the distal convoluted tubule. If we put granular cells together with macula densa, we get the juxtaglomerular apparatus. Maybe in anatomy you've looked at this. I don't make a big deal in anatomy, but probably would be a good idea if I did. Okay. All right, so some of these things have to do with renin. Some have to do with vasoconstriction. All right, so I'm going to turn the lights on right now. I think for you to appreciate that juxtaglomerular apparatus, I think you have to draw it out, right, just like any kind of anatomical structure. So I'm going to erase the board, and we're going to practice drawing that juxtaglomerular apparatus, right, so I can erase this structural and functional unit of urine formation. You got all that down really nice. Okay. Maybe I'll leave that there, but I'll erase this over here. And I got some markers. Okay. All right, so what do we got? We've got this meatball of stuff. What would you think that is? Yeah, glomerulus, right? Okay, and then we have a blood vessel bringing blood into glomerulus. That is the afferent arteriole. We got blood leaving, efferent arteriole. That's not so important for our discussion. But going right between the efferent and afferent arterioles is the distal convoluted tubule. All right, so distal convoluted tubule, okay, is going to be, for instance, like right here, going right between them. And then here is the lumen of the distal convoluted tubule, like so. This area that's close to the afferent arteriole, the cells, right, have a little bit different shape, a little bit different function, like here. Right? And so we're going to call these the macula, nice, macula densa cells. All right, but there's another kind of cell in this area. Granular cells. So here we got a bunch of granular cells, like so. And if you want to draw some granules in there, that's fine with me. All right, and then these are the granular cells. And then both of these things together make up what? The? Yeah, juxtaglomerular apparatus. Okay. So far, I like that. But here is the first confusing thing. These granular cells run around with different names. Right? You got two other different names, and your book uses them kind of interchangeably, and it's hard to, at least it's hard for me to figure out what these are called. Okay? Sometimes they're called JG cells. Right? They're named after me. Is that amazing? JG cells. And a JG cell is a juxtaglomerular cell, right? JG is the same thing as juxtaglomerular, and I don't even have time to write it in here, right? So, cell. All right, so these are here, granular cells, all the same kind of cells. All right, so what is happening here? Okay, I've got all that. Two kinds of processes can take place. Right, we talked about tubuloglomerular feedback is one, and then we're interested in regulating sodium. These are two different things. Okay, so for regulating GFR, tubuloglomerular filtrate, so what is the stimulus? Right, the stimulus is an increase in sodium going through the distal convoluted tubule, right, or even water. So if there's a high flow rate of sodium and water through the distal convoluted tubule, it's going to stimulate the macula densa cells because they have receptors for these things. So what's going to happen then? Okay. The macula densa is going to secrete ATP. And people are almost 100% sure that this is the case, but maybe not. It's sort of hypothesis, sort of theory. All right, so the macula densa cells secrete ATP. The granular cells then are sensitive to ATP. Right, and so you have a high flow rate of water through here when glomerular filtration is really high. So ATP, what should ATP do? If there's a high rate of glomerular filtration because we have a high flow rate coming through here, ATP is going to cause these cells to constrict. That's right. So so GFR granular cells, right? Let's put this right here. Granular cells are going to constrict. Let's see if I can see something about this. Okay. Constrict. Okay, that's going to decrease. Okay, so here is, what do we want to do for glomerular feedback? We want to maintain constant GFR, right? So the stimulus is going to be increased glomerular filtration rate. Macula densa, so what does this do? Macula densa increases the secretion of ATP. ATP from the, so you maybe could draw a little arrow right here. ATP. ATP on the granular cells will vasoconstrict. So I'll put an up arrow here, vasoconstrict. So when there's vasoconstriction of the afferent arteriole, less blood enters the glomerulus. What happens to GFR when that happens? This decreases GFR. And how does that relate to the initial stimulus? Yeah, it's a nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay. And this, we think, is mediated by ATP from macula densa cells acting on the juxtaglomerular cells, or JG cells. All right, so that's one mechanism, okay, that I like. Your book sort of talks about it like that, but maybe in a little bit, believe it or not, more convoluted terms. Yeah. Okay, granular cells, these right here. All right, they cause vasoconstriction. So So they're smooth muscle cells. So they, as soon as they sense this increased ATP, they vasoconstrict, and that reduces flow, Kwasiewicz's law, that decreases glomerular filtration rate. So this would be something that happens when there is, what could be the stimulus of this? Increased blood pressure. Somebody has high blood pressure momentarily. So with higher blood pressure, you're going to have a higher GFR, more filtrate being produced. And so this is just a way to compensate for that increased blood pressure. Even though blood pressure increases, what happens to GFR? It stays the same. Okay? That's the point of this particular mechanism, yeah.
So the vasoconstriction, is that controlled by the synthetic nervous system?
That's a second possibility, yes. So, yeah, and I don't know, should I talk about the sympathetic nervous system? I don't make a really big deal of it. I probably don't even want to say anything about it.
So this is more local?
This is definitely local control. Yeah. And, of course, when I say intrinsic autoregulation, right, that means local control, pretty much the same thing. Okay, so that's the first thing that the juxtaglomerular apparatus does. All right, now here's the second thing. Let's see if I can make this coherent to you. If there is a decrease in sodium, right, or an decrease in osmolality, right, the macula densa cells will be able to sense that, and they're going to send a signal to the juxtaglomerular apparatus, and that juxtaglomerular apparatus is going to secrete renin. All right, so the macula densa cells don't secrete renin, it's the JG cells. All right, so and that's an enzyme, so that's not really a hormone, that's an enzyme, and you're sort of familiar with that. So the signal that the macula densa sends to the JG cells to increase the secretion of renin is a prostaglandin. So it's a prostaglandin, you don't have to know which one, but you probably know that there are some compounds that are prostaglandin inhibitors, used all the time. Aspirin, for instance, NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. All right, so all of those compounds can affect the function of the macula densa cell, can be actually pretty toxic to the kidney. So I don't know if I would recommend anybody take like an NSAID daily because they have some kind of chronic pain in their body. That probably would not be a good idea because it does affect the kidneys. Okay, and the compound that is secreted by, the macula densa, we said was what? A prostaglandin. So decrease in sodium causes an increase in prostaglandin secretion from the macula densa. All right, so what is that? Okay, so that's going to cause the granular cells secrete renin. So now renin is in the blood. And there's a bunch of steps that are going to take place, and I think, though, maybe we can just jump to the very last step. Well, maybe I'll talk about it. What does renin do? It can take angiotensinogen, which is in your blood all over the place, and convert it into angiotensin 1. Okay, and then angiotensin 1 with an enzyme mostly in the lungs, ACE, right, will convert that into angiotensin 2. Angiotensin 2 can go to the adrenal cortex. There's a receptor there for angiotensin 2 to stimulate the cortex to release aldosterone. Nice. All right, so if there's renin secretion, what's the effect on aldosterone? Increases. Okay. So aldosterone increases. Now, what's the effect of aldosterone on the kidney? It's kind of interesting. We started in the kidney, went to the lung, right? Went to the adrenal cortex. Now we're back at the kidney. Okay, so what's the effect of aldosterone? Distal convoluted tubule. This is nice. I'm going to put an arrow here. So it's going to do something to sodium. It's going to increase sodium resorption. Okay, and then kind of as an afterthought, potassium has got to do what? Yeah, it's got to be, okay, resorption, decreased resorption of potassium. And that pretty much happens by increasing secretion in the distal convoluted tubule. This is kind of like an afterthought.
But only potassium is effective.
Anytime aldosterone is there. Yeah. Okay, so here is the effect, increase resorption. So that's going to what? Increase sodium in your body. What was the initial stimulus? Decrease of sodium. Okay, which is what? A nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay, that's as best as I can do on this mechanism. Where do you start? Just make sure you can look at this juxtaglomerular apparatus. Make sure you know the names of these two cells right here, the relationship of the macula densa to the granular cells. And then you got no granular cells, same thing as JG cells, juxtaglomerular cells. It'd be nice if there was a constant uniform terminology for these things. Okay, and that for vasoconstriction, we think macula densa secretes ATP. All right, but the signal for the JG cells to secrete renin is a prostaglandin, which comes from the macula densa cells. Okay, so I think I'm going to turn the lights off right now. Okay, but I'll leave that on the board. All right, so we look at all this stuff right here. So that's just some of the anatomy. So the juxtaglomerular apparatus, when it's activated, releases renin from granular cells. Is that kind of ringing a bell? Renin from granular cells within the, it's a part of the afferent arteriole, not the macula densa. And here's what we said. Renin converts angiotensinogen. You know this is an inactive form because there's the ogen into angiotensin 1, right? Converted into angiotensin 2 by ACE, right? Angiotensin converting enzyme in the lungs. And that goes to the adrenal cortex that stimulates the release of aldosterone, which then causes sodium resorption and potassium secretion. Okay, which I hope this slide here says something like that. Okay, all right, so let's look at an inadequate intake of sodium. Always causes a decrease in blood volume, right? So that's going to decrease blood pressure. So there's a lower osmolality, so when there's a decrease intake of sodium, osmolality decreases, and that inhibits antidiuretic hormone. That's kind of convoluted. You got a couple negatives in here, right? So what is antidiuretic hormone? Antidiuretic hormone makes you retain water, okay? Antidiuretic hormone. Oh, it inhibits antidiuretic hormone, so you're not retaining water, you're going to be losing water. There's just too many negatives the way your book talks about it. That's why I had to draw that on the board. Okay, so low blood volume and renal blood flow stimulate renin release, right? So it's just a direct effect of blood pressure on the granular cells. So there can be two things that secrete renin. Okay, it can be prostaglandins when there's decreased sodium, or directly as a result of low blood pressure. Two things. And also sympathetic activity. Now this is an extrinsic mechanism, and this is initiated by baroreceptors in the arch of the aorta and the carotid sinus. So here is, I think this is an exam figure. Does anybody know if this is an exam figure? Okay. So let's look at this. So the initial stimulus was low intake of sodium. So we have low plasma concentration, right, because we haven't taken a bunch in. The hypothalamus can notice that because there are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus then will signal the posterior pituitary via the tract, will decrease antidiuretic hormones. Let me stop right there and see if I can figure out what's going on. Decrease antidiuretic hormone. So if you have antidiuretic hormone, it makes you retain water, but if you reduce it, that will, make you lose water. Okay, so that decreases water resorption in the collecting ducts, that increases urine volume. All right, so that sort of makes sense. When we increase urine volume, what happens to blood volume? It goes down. Baroreceptors will notice that because there's a decrease in blood pressure that will stimulate the sympathetic nervous system. Right, when there's a decrease in blood volume, the juxtaglomerular apparatus will know that because there is reduced flow through that distal convoluted tubule. And then the JG apparatus is going to secrete renin. And then we got this usual chain of events right here, angiotensin into angiotensin 1, then to 2, going to the adrenal cortex, releasing aldosterone, right? And aldosterone is going to increase resorption of sodium. And so now we have increased retention of sodium in the blood as a response. And what was the stimulus? Low sodium intake. So here's a nice negative feedback mechanism, right, involving antidiuretic hormone and aldosterone. All right, so I can sort of make sense of it in my mind. Anybody make sense of it in your mind, sort of? Can you follow that through there? Okay, so this is pretty easy. This is pretty easy. You just got to remember to couple what ADH with aldosterone over here on the right-hand column. Okay. Here's a really good exam figure. This is not in your textbook, in your study guide. I give you some question marks, but also the answer key. So let's look at that figure as well. Okay. After this slide, I think I only want to show you one more slide. All right, so when we look at aldosterone mechanism of action, this is going to tie in a whole bunch of things that we learned through the whole semester, including some physical chemistry and gene expression and all that stuff. But before we get to talk about that, we got to understand the various components of the anatomy right here. All right, so here we have the lumen of the distal convoluted tubule, not proximal, but way down, yes, past the loop of Henle. Okay, and we said that the distal convoluted tubule is responsible for what? Making adjustments, right, in water resorption or sodium resorption or potassium secretion. And for sodium and potassium, the hormone that has an effect on that regulation is aldosterone. Okay, so here we have the lumen of the distal tubule. What kind of material, what kind of fluid is in the lumen of the distal convoluted tubule? Yeah, jot down filtrate, right? So you're familiar with this area right here. It's filtrate. And we got some sodium in the filtrate, and then we have the wall of the distal convoluted tubule, right? So these are just nice cuboidal cells. It's a simple cuboidal epithelium. And then here is interstitial space, right? So the apical surface of the epithelium, we have filtrate. At the basal lateral surface, we have interstitial fluid. Kind of familiar with that. And then running around underneath it, we have a blood vessel with blood in it, right? So interstitial fluid is part of your body. Blood is part of your body. If something stays in filtrate over here, it will be lost. It will be excreted. Okay. Well, here we have aldosterone in the blood. Okay, aldosterone, I think, that's a steroid, so it actually has a carrier in the blood, a globulin to carry it around, and there's always some equilibrium of free aldosterone and some that's bound to the carrier. So aldosterone can move down its concentration gradient into the interstitial space. And because it's a steroid, can it pass through a plasma membrane if it's a steroid? Yeah, because it's hydrophobic, right? So hydrophobic molecules can move across the plasma membrane. So it moves inside the cell. But aldosterone is a signaling molecule. In order to have an effect on the cell, what does the cell have to have? A receptor, right? If it has a receptor, then this is what we call a nice target tissue or target cell. And where is that receptor located? In the cytoplasm, because aldosterone is a steroid, right? It can get through. All right, now how did we understand the mechanism of action for either nuclear receptors or cytoplasmic receptors. They affected protein synthesis by acting as a transcription factor. All right. All right, so when you make a protein, how many general processes does it require? I like two, maybe three if we think about it really hard, but two I like. What are the two? What's first? Transcription, and then second is translation. Where does transcription always take place? In the nucleus. And what happens for transcription? Remember, transcription is like a photocopy. It's taking DNA, making an exact copy in RNA. All right, that's inside the nucleus, and does that look what's happening on this slide? Sure. Okay, so here we have the receptor bound to aldosterone, goes into the nucleus, acts as a transcription factor, which produces messenger RNA. Right, so that's the first step in protein synthesis. Messenger RNA leaves the nucleus and combines with a ribosome. And when it does, and if you have transfer RNAs and amino acids, then what can happen? Translation can take place, right? So translation and protein synthesis, it's kind of like the same thing. All right, so what kind of proteins are going to be produced? Well, new kinds of channels for sodium and potassium, and it can make more sodium-potassium pumps over here, because that's a protein. And it can also make some proteins that will regulate some pumps that are already existing in the cell membrane. And you know what? These are not pumps. These are just channels. Right? So when they're open, things can move according to their concentration gradient, but it's not primary active transport. All right, so when the genome is activated, producing all these proteins, putting a lot of channels in here and maybe opening channels, let's consider what happens to potassium. Where is potassium usually at a high concentration, inside or outside the cell? High concentration. Yes, inside the cell. And if it's low in the filtrate, which way is potassium going to move? It's by diffusion through this channel. All right, what is that sounding like already? Increased secretion of potassium. What is that kind of sounding like already? That's kind of sounding like aldosterone, right? Because aldosterone, what, increases the secretion of potassium? And here are some sodium channels. Where is sodium at a high concentration? Inside the cell or outside? Outside. When this channel opens up, can you see sodium is going to enter the cell? Right, if you're going from the filtrate back into your body, we call that resorption. All right, so sodium is going to enter the cell. So now we got potassium leaving the cell because it's high. We've got sodium entering. And then we have this primary active transport. What the heck is this thing going to do? It's going to pretty much do the opposite. It's going to import potassium inside the cell so that there's high potassium inside the cell. And if there's high potassium inside the cell, if this channel is open, then it can be secreted, right? Passively secreted, right? And also this sodium-potassium pump is going to drive sodium out, which is going to maintain this gradient so that sodium is resorbed. And when sodium goes into the interstitial fluid, then it becomes high concentration, low in the blood. Sodium will diffuse into the blood. So what's the net effect of aldosterone? Sodium that started in the filtrate and it ended up in blood, and we call that resorption, right? And potassium goes the other way because of this pump right here. We call that secretion. And that's due to, it's due to aldosterone acting as a transcription factor inside this kidney tubule cell. So this is a really nice exam figure because it just recapitulates everything that we learned in class, right? Okay. It's pretty obvious, but I bet there's a couple questions, believe it or not. Yes. Does anybody have a question? Because you know what? It's really not all that simple. But anyway, go ahead.
So they start from the leech tube, or they start from the blood?
Okay. Which compound are you talking about?
These changes happen in
the distal convoluted tubule, yeah. Not proximal convoluted tubule. Okay. Was that your question? Where does it take place in the nephron?
No, these things happen in the nephron, right?
Yes. Distal convoluted tubule. Not proximal. Proximal convoluted tubule doesn't have any aldosterone receptors because it's working as hard as it can to secrete as much potassium as it can, resorb as much sodium as it can. Can't be regulated. It just goes full out. Distal convoluted tubule can be adjusted with aldosterone. Yeah, aldosterone. By acting as a transcription factor, opening up some of these, making new channels, opening some up, making more sodium potassium pumps. All right, so when you think of aldosterone, you think of sodium and potassium going in opposite directions, and now you know the basis for that. What's the fundamental mechanism that makes sure sodium and potassium go in opposite directions? So yeah, this the primary active transporter, the sodium potassium ATP pump. This is the whole reason why that happens. So hopefully that kind of will resonate in your mind for a little while until you get through your board exams. Yeah. Okay. Right here?
Number two.
Oh, sodium excreted?
Yes.
Let's take a look at this light. Oh, potassium. Oh, if there is, right here. If there is excess potassium, okay, yeah, then there's another mechanism for secreting that. Yeah. Yeah, and it's not aldosterone. Aldosterone will cause what? Resorption of potassium. Okay. Yeah, so there is a different mechanism right there. But it can happen in the distal convoluted tubule. Okay, another question. All right, we kind of did all of this already. Remember these two things that the juxtaglomerular apparatus does. One adjusts GFR, the other adjusts sodium via aldosterone. And some of the intermediaries that go between the macula densa and the JG cells. Sometimes it's ATP, sometimes it's a prostaglandin, two different mechanisms. And we talked about this already. And then lastly, so we talked about ADH, aldosterone. Here is atrial natriuretic hormone once again. And the heart is an endocrine gland. When the atria stretch, okay, then the atria secrete atrial natriuretic hormone, and that stimulates salt and water excretion, right? So it acts as an endogenous diuretic, but I don't have a really fancy diagram like this one right here to show you the mechanism. Just remember that it is what? Antagonistic to ADH and aldosterone, okay? And it comes from the heart due to stretching of the heart wall. All right, so that's it for this chapter. So I think you're going to have to go back and look at this. Hopefully you've taken some good notes that we have on the board right here. Your book talks about this. The information is exactly the same, but they use a lot of like negatives and inverse kinds of discussions that I find hard to follow. Hopefully you follow. This is easier to follow. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. The ADH exam figure? That's not in your book?
Yeah,
let's go over that one. That's another nice one that kind of adds everything together that you've learned about in this class. Okay. Okay, so water. Is water hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's a silly question, but let's start there. It is? It's hydrophilic. Can it get through a plasma membrane? It cannot because the plasma membrane is hydrophobic, right? So water normally can't get through a plasma membrane unless there are channels. Sometimes those channels we call pores, right? Okay. So here we have antidiuretic hormone. It's going to have an effect on how water can move through a plasma membrane by controlling some pores. And ADH works through a certain kind of pore that we call an aquaporin. An aquaporin is a channel through a membrane that allows water to diffuse. Okay, and something else I should ask you about ADH, it has another name.
Oh, vasopressin,
that's right. So ADH has an effect on smooth muscle of blood vessels causing constriction, which increases blood pressure. Right. But that's not what we're going to be talking about here. We're just going to be talking about water resorption. So when we talk about resorption, which way does it go? I got filtrate, I've got the wall of a kidney tubule, I got interstitial space, and then I have a blood vessel. Yeah, so if it's water resorption, it's going to go from filtrate into the blood. Let's see if that actually happens. Okay, vasopressin, oh look at that, vasopressin right here in this blood vessel, which is the same thing as antidiuretic hormone. So antidiuretic hormone is going to be the opposite of a diuretic. A diuretic makes you pee, an antidiuretic makes you retain water. All right, so here we have vasopressin in the circulatory system, low in this interstitial space, so it will diffuse out. And of course, what kind of blood vessel does this have to be? Yeah, it's got to be a capillary. I didn't mention it on that other slide, but you should know that that's a capillary, right? That's the only place where exchange happens. Vasopressin is hydrophilic, so can it enter the cell? No, it can't, right? The plasma membrane excludes it, so the receptor for ADH has to be extracellular, right? That's just the way it goes. All right, so ADH is always outside the cell. It can't get inside the cell to signal anything. So what builds up inside the cell that carries the message? The second messenger. And in this particular case, I see ATP being converted into cyclic AMP, a really special form of AMP because it's a cyclic form. And you should know the name of that enzyme. Adenylate cyclase, that's right, adenylate cyclase, and a phosphodiesterase will break it down, right? Okay, so adenylate cyclase becomes activated when ADH binds to this receptor. So now we have second messenger. Where is second messenger always found? Inside the cell. First messenger always outside. This is what we call signal transduction, right? Taking a signal from outside, making a signal appear inside the cell. And cyclic AMP then can work on these endosomes. It can cause a cascade of effects, probably involving some phosphorylation of enzymes and various other kinds of proteins, right? But we should understand what the function of an endosome is. It's a vesicle that contains not something on the inside, but it contains something that is incorporated into the membrane of that vesicle. That's the important thing to know, right? And this thing right here is a water pore that we call aquaporin. And so water can move in and out of this vesicle, no problem, based on just the concentration gradient. But that's not important. What is important is that all these proteins, these aquaporins, are already made, and they're put into vesicles, the membranes of these vesicles, so that if you ever needed to employ these aquaporins at a moment's notice, you could do that by doing what? Not by building more of them, but just by translocating these endosomes over to the plasma membrane, right? And so both of these are phospholipid bilayers, so they just kind of get sucked together, and now you have these aquaporins inserted into the apical surface of the this kidney tubule. So water can diffuse back and forth. And how is water going to diffuse through this aquaporin? Based on? Concentration, right? Based on concentration. So here we have 700 milliosmolar in the vasorecta. Vasorecta is a special peritubular capillary in the medulla of the kidney where it's very salty. Okay, and so it's very salty. The interstitial space is 600 milliosmolar. In the filtrate, it's 300 milliosmolar, and inside the cell, it's about 600 milliosmolar as well. So as soon as these aquaporins are placed in the apical surface of the cell, which way is water going to go? From high concentration, right, 300 milliosmolar to 6, there's a doubling in concentration inside the cell, so water can diffuse through. And then here is another water channel. And water then will be drawn into the capillary, the vasorecta. So what do we call it when water goes from the filtrate back into your circulatory system? Resorption. And what does that do to urine production? Okay, when water moves from filtrate back into the body, what happens to urine formation? It decreases. Would that be a diuretic or an antidiuretic that does it? An antidiuretic that does that, and hence the name for this particular hormone. All right, but this is in a special space in the kidney called, or special nephron, that goes way down to the vasorectus. It's not a cortical, it's a juxtamedullary nephron. And deep inside the medulla of the kidney, it's very salty, and that's what drives this process right here. Okay, and where does this happen? Not the proximal convoluted tubule, but yeah, collecting duct, primarily. Okay. Yeah, this is online, part of your study guide. Okay, so I have some of these things erased with question marks, and then I also give you this exact figure that you can use as an answer key. Yeah, question. Indeed. Because this 300 milliosmolar, right, I see it low here and then a bigger number, then a bigger number here. The milliosmolar is not a measure of water, it's really a measure of the salt, right? It's a measure of the solute that's in the solution. So as the salt increases, what happens to water? It decreases. So 700 milliosmolar is a lot less water than 300 milliosmolar, because what we're showing with these numbers is the concentration of solutes. Okay? So again, you have to like think backwards. Okay? So that was a good question. So how is that discussion? Pretty good? Do I need to look at that again? Both of those are really nice exam figures. Okay, so that's pretty much it for the kidneys. And just remember this dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, what the effect is on sodium and potassium. That's really handy. And the three hormones responsible for regulating blood pressure, because it regulates blood volume, would be antidiuretic hormone, aldosterone, and atrial natriuretic hormone. And some are antagonistic to each other. Okay. So I got our clock. I got our clock back working, and I stuck it right there. All right. So our last chapter, right, is the diversification system. So I'm going to end this right here. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I have any slides either. I don't have any slides right here. I'm not even sure if I have any pictures from your textbook. So, diversification system. So I want to just give you a little bit of background. Diversification system. Too bad I mentioned it. I would like to know what the function of the reproductive system is. What's the function of the reproductive system? Make babies. You know what? I can't disagree with that, but I think there's a more fundamental reason. Yeah, ensure the survival of the species. That's critical. That's actually really critical information. Okay. Okay. And how does it go about doing that? How does it ensure survival of the species? Okay. Okay. For instance, there are very few disease processes that will affect everybody in a population, right? And we could think of this room as a little population. Somebody might have a cold, but not everybody. Somebody might have a flu, but not everybody, right? And why is it that some people can catch a cold and others don't? Because we're all different, right? Some people have different immune systems. Some people ran into other kinds of viruses previously, maybe have some immunity against it, okay? And so that's an important consideration. And reproduction can take a couple different forms. Let's just say that I am a sea anemone or a hydra. It's a polyp, right? The sea anemone has a body tube. It's got a bunch of tentacles, and it's kind of moving around in the water column. When it bumps into a food particle, it can sting it because it has nematocysts, right? And then the tentacle brings it over to the body tube, and the body tube ingests it, and that's how the hydra gets nourishment, right? And a lot of times these things are sessile, they just kind of sit there. But when they reproduce, right, all of a sudden, they form a little bud on the side of the body tube, right? And then the bud gets a little bit bigger, and then it starts to grow some tentacles, and the body tube gets a little bit bigger, and it just looks like a baby hydra, which is what you told me what our reproduction system does, right? It makes new ones of us. right? And then when that baby hydra gets big enough, the bud drops away and it becomes another hydra someplace and does its own kind of thing. Okay, that reproduction is called asexual reproduction. So the baby is exactly like the parent. So if the parent is going to get sick because of some reason, what can you tell me about the offspring? It gets sick as well. All right, so that's not a really good way for reproduction, right? Because we said everybody in here will not come down with the same kind of disease process. So the purpose of our reproductive system is to introduce diversity into our population so that we're not all the same. And so there's a couple of questions that kind of pop to mind. So how many sexes do we have? Yeah, we got two. How come we don't have three sexes or four sexes? Because with two sexes, we're all different anyway. So there's no need to have three sexes, right? Because there is a lot of diversity already. And is that true? Is there another you anywhere else in the world? Like if you go to the Colosseum and there's a football game and you have a million people in the Colosseum and you look around, will you ever find another you? No. Okay. Okay. So I know sex is really complicated. Right, some of us have a penis and testes, other vagina and ovaries and all that kind of stuff. Why is it so complicated? So that the population is diverse. Right, it's different than just asexual reproduction. Here is something else that's sort of interesting. If your parents had you, right, obviously they had you and you grew up, 10 or 15 laters, could they make another you? Could they make another you? I see yes, and I kind of see people shaking their heads no. All right, and the answer is pretty strange. Right, the answer is absolutely yes. If they made you, why can't they make another you? Right, I mean, all that information is right there. All right, but because we have all these different sex organs and the way that sexual reproduction takes place, the odds of making another you are astronomical to where it probably has never, ever happened and will never happen. Right, because of meiosis and the way that gametes combine. So it is possible, but because of our anatomy and how things work, it just won't ever happen again, which what maintains diversity in the population. Okay, so it is possible for them to make another you, but don't waste your time looking around for another you. Okay, so that is the function of our reproductive system is to maintain diversity, and so that's why I call it the diversification system, and that's probably more important than thinking of it as the reproductive system, right? It's easy to reproduce. It's more complicated to make something new and unique. So you are all new and unique, right? And you'll never find another you because of that. Well, how does that happen? Wow, I have to erase this. All right, so here is a cell. It's a human cell. And a human cell has 46 chromosomes on the inside. And if everything's normal, it should be an even number. Why should it be an even number? Because half are from your mom, half are from your dad. From your dad are called paternal chromosomes. From your mom are maternal. All right, and so we are all just like the single cell. Anybody know what the single cell is called? That is a zygote. Yeah, indeed, that's a zygote, just a single cell. But it's a fully human cell because it's got all these 46 chromosomes. Not a very interesting stage in life because if you're a zygote, you can't go to the gym, you can't come to physiology lecture, right? Nothing like that. So what has to happen? This thing is going to, split into these cells right here. And this is nice, like so. All right, so what's the difference between this top cell and this bottom cell? What about the shape? Same. What about size? Same. Number of chromosomes? Color? Everything's the same. So these are identical cells. These are what we call, daughter cells. And what do we call this over here? The zygote, this is a parent. That's a parent cell. This process that produces two identical cells based on the zygote is called, mitosis, right? Mitosis like that. Okay, so then we have billions of cells that makes our body. All right, so how do we reproduce? Well, we got to take a cell that looks like this and cut the number of chromosomes down in half. So we end up with a cell with 23 chromosomes in it. So that's half a human cell. That's got kind of a general name, so it doesn't matter if it's male or female. The general name is gamete. Right, that's a gamete. And what's the process that takes a cell and produces a gamete out of it? That's not mitosis, but that's meiosis. Right? So meiosis is a nuclear reduction technique. All right, so, and if this is a male, what are we going to call this thing? If this is a male gamete, then it's sperm. Okay. And if it is a female gamete, we're going to call this an egg or an oocyte. But it's got to have 23 chromosomes. And then if everything goes as planned, okay, this sperm is going to bump into this egg, and it's going to do what? It's going to produce this thing once again. And what is this thing called? What is this arrow called? Yeah, that's fertilization. Nice. Okay, so this is what we call sexual reproduction. And what do we need? We need two sexes. And this process of mitosis makes sure that all of these sperm are different, all these eggs are different, and when they recombine, it even produces more diversity. And so that's why we have some of these different structures in our body. Now, to make this egg right here, it takes certain kinds of endocrine profiles in the female. Okay, there are some FSH, LH, and the male has FSH and LH as well. Okay, but these will have an effect on the ovary, and these will have an effect on the testes. The ovary will secrete estrogen and progesterone. And in the male, what is the male testes going to secrete? Only testosterone. Testosterone. That's close. Okay. Ah, notice that. Women get two, men only get one. You ladies should be really sensitive to the plight of males. Okay, so what we're interested in, what we're going to look at next time, okay, where FSH and LH come from, what their target tissue is, and how the target tissue responds by producing estrogen and progesterone or testosterone. And in particular, we're going to be interested in this control up over here. And then what are the effects of estrogen on the female body? What are the effects of progesterone on the female body? How all this stuff is regulated and the structures involved. Okay, so estrogen produces secondary sex characteristics in females. What does progesterone do? Where did they get this name, progesterone? Like carbohydrate means carbon hydrate, means carbon with water on either side, progesterone. Has anybody ever heard of gestation? What's gestation? Yeah, it's when somebody's pregnant. What does pro mean? Supports, yeah, or before. So progesterone supports pregnancy. Right, so when progesterone is high, the body has a tendency to think that it is pregnant. Right, so to maintain pregnancy, we need, or some people need, high progesterone. All right, so look at that figure, which is the profile, the hormone profile. Is this it? 20.33. So we're going to look at that next time.
About book reading assignments.
Yeah, I'm going to have to mail that out to you.
Okay.